disperse immediately or you will be subject to arrest with now.
A boss ain't nothing but a thief on a time loan. 128 bit war, you play Nintendo on some shooter, so put the bridge down and feed us to the killer bees. We get what we deserve, life. Bury me with my MP3s. Write my manifesto in 72 DPI. Life's just a game, you got cheated, never learn. I write these songs every bridge that ain't been burned. For every cop car that ain't been turned.
Okay. Just so people don't know, do you just want to introduce yourself real quick?
Sure. My name is Daniel Yildirim. I'm part of the Catholic Worker Movement, and I was part of the team that shut down the Line 4 pipeline that belongs to Enbridge up in the Northland a few weeks ago.
We're going to be talking about the case and different parts of it, what's going on, what this means for environmental direct action in the future, and lots of other stuff. But just to get started, what is the Catholic Worker Movement? Where does it come from, and you know, what is it all about?
Well, the Catholic Worker Movement emerged in during the Great Depression in New York City, and it was founded by Dorothy Day and a Frenchman called Peter Morin, and they started hospitality houses in New York City, which were places that would feed and clothe the poor. They were taking the message of the gospel very seriously, and they developed this idea called personalism, where we take personal responsibility for the ills that we perceive in the world, and that we don't rely on power structures to solve these problems for us. So the Catholic Worker is not associated in any official way with the Catholic Church. A lot of, I'd say maybe the majority of Catholic workers are practicing Catholics, but a lot of them aren't. And, yeah, so they really have this, anarchist power structure where there's no centralized chain of command or anything like that. They're not connected with the, you know, highly hierarchical Catholic Church. So it's really like Catholicism plus anarchism. And they have been involved for, over 70 years now. Like I said, doing hospitality, caring for the poor. They also have a strong element of Catholic worker farms, where people are going into rural areas and starting farms based on the principles of the Gospels. And also they have this strong component of direct action. So they've been involved in getting arrested for justice and, you know, stepping in the way of violence with their bodies for a very long time now.
It's very interesting you brought up the farm aspect. What is the size and the capacity of the farms, would you say?
They're all small farms. It's related to the ethic that small is beautiful. Uh-huh. And that scale is very important when it comes to ethical ways of producing food.
Is the food that produced, is that like then sold in marketplaces to like make money for the group's projects, or is that then like brought into cities to use in the food distribution and servings that you all do?
Yeah, so there's a huge diversity of methods and strategies for how to get the food out of the ground into people's mouths. I was just at the Northern Midwest Catholic Worker Farmer Gathering a couple of weeks ago, which was really beautiful. There were about 60 or 70 people there, and listening to everybody talk about their different strategies and models was really inspiring. A lot of people, you know, they sell some and then they give some as a gift to people in town or the city. Some people have CSAs. I have a raw milk business that I offer milk as a gift to people in my community. So there's, yeah, lots of different ways of beautifully using the food that comes out of our land.
Awesome. Well, that could be a whole podcast in itself. That's very interesting. But yeah, I think a lot of people listening may or may not have heard of the Catholic Worker Movement. I know I think there's still a newspaper that's produced.
Right, out of New York City. And there's lots of periodicals that are produced, lots of different zines and things like that.
Right. There's a lot of different locals across the U.S. that are doing work under this banner.
Right.
But I'm just curious. So coming out of this movement, what inspired you all to take action in regard to Line 3, the pipelines?
Well, Catholic workers have been involved in the struggle around the Enbridge pipelines up north for a number of years now. A lot of the impetus for our work comes out of solidarity with indigenous groups up there, tribal groups, which continue to be violated by the machinery of capitalism. And we see it as important to recognize the ongoing atrocity of indigenous violation of indigenous rights under capitalism, and to take personal responsibility for it, stand in the way, and do whatever is in our power to stop that from happening.
Were there similar actions in the past that inspired you? I know that there have been other people, I think in Canada and the U.S., that have scaled into places and turned off the valve similarly. Was there something that happened in the past that you all looked to, or what was it that kind of brought this idea on?
Yeah, so there were a number of previous valve turnings. There was a group of indigenous women who turned the valves in Canada. I think they were the first ones to do it. And their message was that Enbridge is colonial violence. There were a number of valve turnings in Quebec that you can look up on YouTube. And then maybe the most well-known were the valve turners in 2016. They had a very well-coordinated effort at four different sites across the United States. And that was really inspiring. Ken Ward was one of those figures. He was in Washington State, and then Leonard Higgins in Montana, and then another one in North Dakota. And then there were two women, Annette and Emily, whose last names I don't remember right now, Emily Johnston. And they were very close to where we were up in northern Minnesota, kind of in the Bemidji area.
And in this case, in 2016, this is the famous case where people argued essentially that there was a necessity to take these actions because of climate change, and they won on those grounds, correct?
Well, not exactly. Ken had a hung jury. He was not allowed to argue the necessity defense. It's been very rare that activists have had judges that have permitted them to argue the necessity defense. The necessity defense is basically saying, I did commit this crime, but I essentially had to do it in order to prevent a greater harm from being done. And climate change represents this enormous threat to all of humanity and ecosystems on Earth. So therefore, you know, this trespassing and that I committed was by far the lesser act of violence. Leonard in Montana did 6 months in prison. Annette and Emily, the gentleman in North Dakota, I think, also went for a year maybe to prison. And Annette and Emily were the ones who were most successful pre-trial in getting the judge to say that, yes, we're going to hear the necessity to defense in front of a jury. And this is kind of the holy grail for climate legal strategy, to get a jury to hear the necessity to defense and then, you know, ultimately to be acquitted on the necessity defense. But of course, Enbridge, the pipeline corporation, doesn't want a well-publicized trial in which people are explaining eloquently and rationally that we need to take direct action in order to prevent the catastrophe of climate change. So we think they kind of sabotaged the case a little bit and overreached. And the judge ultimately threw it out due to lack of evidence before the trial even began. So they didn't even really get a trial. They didn't get acquitted. The judge threw it out.
How do you feel like actions, the ones that you are involved in, support our larger movements or struggles involving other groups of people?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. Climate change is an unprecedented crisis that humanity is facing. We've never dealt with anything on this scale before. So obviously there are groups all around the world who are working locally or regionally to try and slow down or stop the fossil fuel industry in any way that they can. Subcomandante Marcos from the Zapatistas described this as World War IV. You know, he said that the Cold War was World War III, and that we're now engaged in World War IV, where the forces of corporate capitalism are racing each other to devour the last of the commons, and people all around the world have to engage locally in a nonviolent struggle in order to stop the ultimate destruction of our species. This is how we see ourselves as regionally engaging. You know, this pipeline, Enbridge is trying to expand Line 3 right now. Line 3 is a pipeline that brings tar sands oil from the Athabasca tar sands in Canada down to a terminal in the United States. And Enbridge really needs this pipeline to go in to really save their company because they're struggling. And we see, as activists, this opportunity to step in and create a real difference by preventing that line from going in and maybe, you know, making a real difference on the global scale of how much fossil fuels are being extracted and burned.
Of course. Can you talk a little bit, I mean, theoretically, about the thought process behind turning off the valves? I mean, what are people hoping to accomplish? It could be even in regards to the message that's getting across, but I mean, these actions do, I mean, have big effects on just the outflow of oil. I'm just curious if you can talk about the theory behind it as well.
Do you mean like the thought process going into the action?
Well, like what is it physically doing to the infrastructure of the oil network, I guess?
Yeah, so the pipelines will run about 800,000 gallons per hour of oil, including the tar sands oil that's in Line 3 and 4 where we were working. So turning off the valves, you know, does prevent a lot of oil from going to market. However, a huge part of the significance of the action is symbolic. I think that the safety valves on these pipelines, they're federally mandated to be there, and they exist in case of emergency. And they exist, you know, in case of the kind of emergency where the electrical system is down, and a human being has to step in to physically, with their hands, turn off the flow of the oil. So the way that we look at it, we are in a crisis of the highest magnitude right now as a species. And it's vitally necessary that we stop the output of fossil fuels, that we stop their extraction and transportation. Our legal and political systems have been totally debilitated in their ability or willingness to do what needs to be done in order to preserve the human species. So, you know, seeing as the valves are an emergency override, they seem like the perfect mechanism for people to take direct action and use their hands to turn off the flow of the oil. It's kind of like the emergency democratic process for these pipelines.
Yeah. Yeah, it just shows you also too, just, I mean, the infrastructure is there. I mean, it's out amongst the world, and these things can, you know, be shut down if people want to.
Right.
But just moving forward, I mean, I think that actions like these are very courageous on the part of everyone that takes them. I mean, they're putting themselves in harm's way. I'm just curious how you deal with the fear created by the state and corporations putting their sights so strongly on water protectors and people taking these actions. I mean, anybody that follows, you know, the laws that are being passed, I mean, it's very scary. I mean, they're very much setting their sights on anybody that wants to put a finger on oil infrastructure.
Right. Legislatures across the country are amping up the laws that would prevent activists from being effective, or, you know, amping up the punishments that they would give out. And I think fear is something that we all have to deal with, those of us who are taking actions that are illegal in the defense of all life. So I think, yeah, doing fear work is extremely important. I've also found, to my surprise, after the action, I have felt, you know, I've had moments of fearfulness, but I've also felt, to some extent, some diminishment or evaporation of that fear. I think as I feel myself coming more into my power, and I feel myself using my gifts for the greater good, and being used by spirit in ways that you know, feel really right to me, I feel less afraid of the mechanisms of the corporate state. You know, they're only humans, and we really have truth on our side. So I think beforehand I was quite fearful of, you know, private security firms that Enbridge is employing, and Enbridge itself, and the mechanisms of the state that they utilize. But, you know, I'm getting to this place now where I'm really feeling like Enbridge is the scared one. Enbridge is, you know, feeling cornered. Public opinion about climate change is rapidly moving against their favor. They know that they are doing something immoral, and they're trying to keep it under wraps and hide it. And every day it's becoming more and more exposed. And they see that they're not going to be able to keep up the sham for very much longer. You know, and I realized I was doing research about the previous valve turners, and I noticed that the press release that Enbridge put out for the 2016 valve turners was word for word the same as the one that they put out for us. So I was like, you know, you guys don't even have a new press release. You're still putting out the same lame stuff from 3 years ago. I feel like I have new material every day. You know, I'm like, I have lots of creative arguments and lots of things to say. So I feel like Enbridge is really on the run, and I feel powerful, and I feel like calling out Enbridge and saying, you know, you better change your ways and, you know, abandon ship or start investing in green energy, because people like me we see what's happening, and we're not going to turn away, and we're going to keep advancing, and your time is limited.
Mm-hmm. You know, I'm curious, did you go to Sending Rock at all? Did that have any impact on your trajectory at all?
I was part of a team that sent two people to Standing Rock. I was part of the support team for that, so I stayed back but was in close contact. And our team was at the Sacred Stones camp, I think from maybe May onwards, so very early, back when it was just a dozen people.
Right.
So I
remember that time, too.
Right, so I was following it very closely, and you know, in daily contact with those folks there, and was really inspired by what it turned out to be. And, you know, I experienced a whole different mix of emotions from how it went down. But I think right now what we're thinking about is, what are the lessons that we can take from Standing Rock and apply them to what's coming up this summer in the Line 3 fight? Because Enbridge is right now in consultation with those private security firms like Tiger Swan that were at Standing Rock. And we know from Tiger Swan's own internal documents that they think that they won, and they think that the battle was won because of their tactics. So they're at this very minute talking with Enbridge, saying, this is what we did at Standing Rock. This is how we took them down. This is how we created problems among the activist groups, created conflict, and this is what we're going to use again. So the people I'm working with, we're trying to figure out what information we can disseminate that will be most useful to activist groups moving forward, so that we can develop strategies of resilience against what is essentially counterintelligence work that they're doing. You know, they have their
insurgency,
right? Counterinsurgency work that they developed in the Middle East.
Because so much of counterinsurgency is about not only the military aspect, but physically turning the population against the insurgents, or, you know, the people that are organizing to push back against any form of state authority. But I'm curious. I mean, obviously, I mean, Standing Rock was a huge deal because it brought so many different kinds of people into the struggle in a variety of ways, like whether they were sending money or, you know, their weird uncle went off and went there for a couple months or something, and, you know, they were posting about it on Facebook. I mean, I know people that have no political bone in their body, but, you know, they were connected to Standing Rock and they felt a connection to that struggle, which was really amazing. Do you think there's a way to turn enough people within the public against Tiger Swan would that have an impact on what they're doing, or no?
I certainly hope so. Anything's possible. I think they have really effective PR strategies.
Uh-huh.
And I think what they really emphasize is the violent nature, the supposed violent nature of the activists. So they're really, yeah, which is ironic, of course. But, right, so they see themselves as the good guys. They are protecting the workers from these violent and dangerous activists. So anything that they can use to depict us as violent or erratic or dangerous, they will use in their favor. And, of course, a lot of the violence that was going on there was the result of agent provocateurs who were probably from Tiger Swan, you know. And I think you get a group of several thousand people together from all over the country, it's messy, and there's going to be all kinds of people there. So,
well, I mean, they were the ones walking around with, you know, AR-15s and stuff. I mean,
right. They were the ones bringing military hardware and attack dogs and everything like that. That's always how violence is justified, you know, is by people painting themselves as the victim and, you know, characterizing it as a necessary defense that they were engaged in.
Well, I mean, I think it was clear to most people. I mean, just from the start that, I mean, you know, there was a community up above, or I think it was above Standing Rock, that voted against having the pipeline come through their land. And then it was, of course, oh, no, put it down where the native people are, down below. I mean, it was obvious that the military and the Tiger Swan people were all there to protect the oil infrastructure and make sure the pipeline went through. And I think that's why so many people supported what was going on in Standing Rock, is because it was, you know, a real underdog story of just everyday broke people standing up against this monstrosity of power.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's what the military is essentially for, right? Is to protect the existing structures of power. And,
yeah.
Indigenous people, have been and are politically disenfranchised. So it's a lot easier for a corporation like, TransCanada to just, you know, the negative effects of their project. It's a lot easier to put that on, Indigenous people.
Right.
Or people of color. Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit more about Line 3? I know we've had Anti-Colonial Land Defense on the program before, and they've talked about Line 3. They're doing stuff like almost every day. There's actions popping off. But can you just talk a little bit about Line 3? Why is it important? And what do people need to know about it in terms of getting ready to mobilize around it?
Yeah. So Enbridge is trying to pitch this as a replacement line, that they're replacing an old pipe for safety purposes, which isn't entirely wrong. The current Line 3 is very decrepit. It dates from the 60s. Tar sands oil is incredibly corrosive, so the pipeline is paper thin at places and is really prone to leaks. And what really needs to happen is that line needs to be discontinued and removed with nothing replacing it, because that is the time we are at in history, and that's what's necessary in order to protect life at this point. However, what Enbridge has in mind, and they're calling this the biggest project in their entire history as a company, and they've been around for quite some time, is that they are going to replace Line 3 with a higher volume pipe. And so they are going to be able to put a lot more oil through the new replaced Line 3. Right now, they're only able to run it at half capacity because it's in such bad shape. So it's going to be a bigger diameter pipe, and they're going to be able to run it at full capacity. So it's going to increase the output of tar sands oil by quite a lot. And it's important to understand that the tar sands projects up in Alberta, which James Hansen has called game over for the climate, if they're allowed to extract everything that they're planning to extract, its biggest bottleneck right now is getting that oil out of there cheaply and effectively. So this is really a linchpin in the whole project of the tar sands oil field. And, you know, I read a statistic the other day that if they burn everything that they want to burn from the tar sands fields, that project alone will cause a 1 degree rise in global average temperature. And I believe that's Fahrenheit. I'm not sure. But, you know, there's just a vast amount of oil there, and it's very costly and inefficient to burn it right. and to extract it. So we're really seeing this as a major flashpoint in the global effort to preserve life on this planet right now. And the latest developments are that the governor of Minnesota, Governor Walz, decided to put the permitting process back into appeals. He said, you know, you have the legal permit, but you also need a social permit. This is a very controversial project, and we're putting it back into the appeals process. The spokesperson for Enbridge, their response was, well, we're going to be operational November 1st. So even if they win the appeals process, that means that they're going to have to get started before they have got the necessary permits. So that's a strategy that TransCanada was pursuing. If you remember at Standing Rock, before they had the permits from the Army Corps of Engineers, before they were actually allowed legally to be putting in the pipeline, they went ahead and did it anyway, because they see the fines as just a cost of doing business. So essentially, the pipeline corporations are doing direct action themselves. They're breaking the law and just paying the fines. So for me, and for a lot of people I know, this is going to be a huge mandate for mass direct action.
And you foresee that there's going to be, because I mean, there's a lot going on already right now, but you foresee mass mobilizations against this?
I can't really say with certainty what's going to happen. That's kind of the way I see things leading towards. You know, the Duluth City Council just paid hundreds of thousands of dollars for military-grade hardware. It seems right. like Enbridge and the government and police forces are gearing up for a similar kind of battle as Standing Rock, this time in the northlands of Minnesota and Wisconsin. So they seem to think that that's what's happening, or they're taking precautionary measures anyway. Right. I would check out Honor the Earth. Honor the Earth has really been great leadership in this project. And, you know, Winona LaDuke has been fighting Line 3 for years and years. So I think it's really important to pay attention to them.
I mean, it's so sick when you think about it. I mean, these corporations, because, I mean, they've known since, what, the 70s, I think Exxon put its first report out about climate change. You know, it's not like we're running out of oil somehow. I mean, there's surplus amounts of oil since they've been fracking it to get at it. You know, it has more to do with just wanting to suck up as much excess amount of wealth as they can before, you know, the economy collapses or there's the oil bubble bursts. It's just disgusting because, I mean, they know what's at stake. They know what they're doing to the planet, and yet they're just pushing it farther and farther. It seems like they themselves have a death drive more than anything.
Right. I think that's really true. And I think there's – I really don't know. I imagine there's a lot of cynicism at top levels of investorship and the corporate officers.
Well, it's almost like if we don't do it, somebody else will, you know, and we might as well get rich from it than somebody else.
Right. And you see that argument a lot, even in op-ed pieces, and Republicans say that kind of thing of this, you know, they say, well, we know this is terrible, but if we don't do it, somebody else will. And I always say, is that what you teach your children, that if I don't do it, somebody else will? Or is that what your pastor would say?
Right.
Or how would Jesus respond to that kind of argument, if the money changers at the temple said, well, if we don't do this, somebody else is going. It's a
right.
it's a totally inexcusable moral argument. But that's really all they have to stand on. But I think we can, you know, maybe have empathy for them, that, you know, for somebody to have that kind of viewpoint, to be so addicted to an ideology and to privilege, to be willing to dispose of the rest of the human species, not to mention all of the other animal and plant species that are going to go down with us, I think is a really sad thing. And I think we really need to reach out to them and provide them an out and say, you know, you don't have to dig yourself deeper and deeper into this dark, ugly hole. You can really step out with us and join the fight to save humanity and life as we know it on this planet. And I think that's an important feature of Kingian nonviolence. You know, Martin Luther King said, one difference between violent and nonviolent conflict is at the end of a nonviolent conflict, when the struggle is successful, everyone will celebrate together. There won't be domination of one group over another group and one group kind of tucking their tail between their legs and going and hiding as second class citizens or something. But we're all going to be celebrating together.
Well, I wanted to turn now. I mean, one of the things we've been talking about on this program is as the 2020 elections, you know, get closer, there's more and more of a push from people in the center to put more faith in elections. And of course, we have, of course, put more faith in direct action and social movements and everyday people to take control of their lives and create a different form of life. And I'm just curious, you know, looking at what passes often as climate activism in the United States. I mean, just in the past couple of years, we've seen mass marches, whether it's like the Science March or the various climate marches, which, you know, bring out tens of thousands of people. And we've always asked, like, you know, where are those numbers for, you know, the direct action campaigns that would really have an effect massively on the fight against global warming? I'm just curious, I mean, you know, especially now as there's more and more talk of the Green New Deal and things like that, how do we get a lot of these people that are more into these kind of passive, symbolic, you know, forms of trying to pressure the Democrats to do X, Y, Z and get them really involved in these really much needed direct struggles on the ground?
Yeah, I think that's a really important question. I think people are really they're stuck in this ideology that somebody else is going to fix things, and that if we could just get the power holders to see it our way, or if we could just get the right person elected, then our problems would go away. I'm always trying to make the point that it's not the person in power that's the problem. It's the system of power that they are in. And I think it's very sinister the way that, and I'm not saying it's intentionally sinister, but this is the way that it works out, that our national political system winds up being kind of like a big absorbing cushion for people's hopes and terror and ambition and dreams and fears. If you look at, for example, when a presidential candidate on election night has won, the level of energy in the stadium or wherever they are is incredible. And you can really see that people have invested so much emotional energy into putting this person in the Oval Office. And I think afterwards they're really just drained, and that's like all the energy that they can afford, is because for the last 2 years they've been just putting all of their energy into trying to get this person elected, and they need 2 years of recovery before they can get started again. And it winds up sapping everybody's strength. And, you know, we elected what seemed to be like a pretty radical president back in 08 with Obama. And, you know, we find ourselves just pretty much on the same trajectory 10 years later. So I would really I think the Green New Deal is great. I think we should support politicians. I personally don't feel called to spend a lot of time engaging in the conventional political systems, especially, you know, the further away that these systems are from me, the more I feel like they're illegitimate. So my local, you know, my county board and city council, I feel like are very legitimate and are worthy of my investing a lot of time in. But, you know, the Democrats and Republicans in Washington, D.C., it seems like just such a big energy suck for people. And they're fighting these battles that I think aren't even really relevant. They're fighting these identity battles of, you guys are the bad guys and you're so stupid and we're the good guys. And it seems like the Congress is just a totally broken machine. And I think the Green New Deal is beautiful. I don't know. I have some fears that people are going to put all of their hopes into this boat, and then the powers at that level will not let that boat sail. And then we're going to find ourselves, you know, another 5 years down the road saying, oh gosh, we tried so hard with this thing, and now we're in an even worse position than we were 5 years ago. When I think you're right, that if people really mobilize together and locked arms with their neighbors and looked at each other and said, what can we do in our place or in our region, and really take matters into our own hands in a nonviolent way, in a loving way, then I think that would be a more effective means of change.
And that's where, I mean, the elites will be pushed into a position where they have to, like, make some sort of change, is when the situation appears like it's going to get out of their control. I mean, that's historically when they've been pushed to make those big changes. Not when just somebody's like, I have an idea. Let's do a bunch of things that really, you know, go against the interests of, you know, major corporations. I mean, that's, I just don't see it happening.
Right. Even Bernie Sanders, who was running for president, was saying, you know, political change never really happens until social movements make them happen. You know, it's like the political change is the last thing that changes after we've all decided on the ground in the streets that this is the way it needs to go, because power never concedes anything unless it absolutely has to.
And, you know, also at the end of the day, I mean, if this system is going to continue, it's going to have to adapt. It's going to have to become socially democratic in some regards. You know, it's, you can't automate people out of existence and then just have nothing for them to do or nowhere for them to survive on. You know, you can't destroy the environment and just expect, you know, the system to continue. It's going to have to reform itself in some regards if it's going to survive. And I mean, I think beyond just, you know, that aspect, we have to then ask ourselves, like, do we want capitalism to survive? Do we want, like, a greener form of wage slavery? And I would, of course, argue no.
Right. Yeah, I think that we kind of have a failure of creativity and imagination in our culture, where we assume that the dreams that we are being fed by the elites are the only thing, the only possibility for the future. So this,
exactly,
this future, which is going to be higher technology and more automated. When I talk to people about it, the response I often get is like, yeah, I mean, I don't like it, but what are you going to do? That's what's happening. Right. And people don't realize that we are the ones who are making all of these things happening. We have a choice. We are free beings, and we can say, I don't want to go in that direction. You know, we could spend our energy replenishing the biodiversity and vitality of the Great Lakes and we could spend a huge amount of energy doing that so that the Great Lakes were a huge source of food for all the people living around the Great Lakes.
Or we could all learn to code at 60.
Right. I mean, there's there's an infinite number of things that we could choose to do with our collective energy. And it's unfortunate that it seems like we just buy whatever the elites are telling us through television and the internet of this is happening. So let's all just go along with this.
Right. Sorry, I was being sarcastic. I just watched this program on automation, and basically the message of it was like, if you don't want to get left behind, you know, you better go to a coding camp, even if you're 60, because there's going to be no other way for you to support yourself, because your job is going to be done by an AI robot. Which, and again, like you said, I mean, we could actually just think of all the energy and human knowledge that goes into that. It's like, why aren't we actually doing something that's going to prolong us, that's going to create a world for our children, that's going to ensure that there's going to be more biodiversity, more life, more connection into the future as opposed to less? I mean, it makes literally is nonsensical.
Yeah, and I think the question I always ask with technology, I mean, I'm not opposed to technology blindly, but I think I always ask, what does this do to the power structures in our society if we adopt this technology? Does it make it so that the power is more disseminated among the population, that I am actually more empowered? Or is it actually enriching a very small number of people and making us dependent on them culturally?
Is there ways that people can support you and your comrades as you face these trials coming up for the actions? What can they do to support, and where can they go to either donate or stay up on the case?
Yeah, I think the number one thing is seek out other people in your community who feel inspired in the way that you do, and just realizing that we can't be effective without a community support, and that major strategy that is employed against us is to keep us separated. So whether that be grief work or some kind of, you know, support of direct action or community gardens, I encourage people to just follow their hearts and really go into discernment with people that they love and care about, and support other people in the dreams that they have for a more beautiful world. As far as us, the Four Necessity Valve Turners, you can visit our Facebook page at Four Necessity, and you can get to our website from there. Yeah, there is a donate button there for our, you know, travel expenses for our lawyers and things of that nature. Yeah, I think just getting educated and sending us your prayers and love and support, which we've been receiving a lot of, we're very fortunate, is hugely important to us.
Well, awesome. Thank you so much for coming on the program and sharing everything from the Catholic Worker to just your thoughts on climate change. It's been very inspiring. Anything else you want to add?
Yeah, I just want to say that I feel like I have been extremely lucky to be on this path, and just sending out a message of gratitude to everyone who's been on the journey with me. And I love you, and yeah, I can't wait to see what's going to come next.
I got a message. 1, 2, 3 to the foe. The big bad wolf hit a knock on your door. Young CNG, you can call me, comes and goes. I'm that young individual knocking on your. Just left the crib, going to the SWAT. 94 Civic, you can catch me on your block. Talking to the cops, cause your ass got robbed. The type of shit on this side will get your ass shot. All the homies put me up on game, so I stayed with it. Told me about the nines and the drugs, never played with it. Everybody tripping in the streets, got a mug at me. Cause I'm a young Mexicano in the industry. I give a damn about your blood, race, and color. If you my main dog, then best believe you my brother. Real shit, when you stand right in front of me, vandalized outlaws, saying fuck the industry. Breath. Fuck Donald Trump. From the wild, wild west, where they screaming, fuck Donald Trump.
Okay, we are back for another week. Lots been going on. Obviously, Cohen has testified in front of Congress. Also, in the Senate, they're mulling over a vote on whether or not people are going to continue to support Donald Trump's so-called emergency. Also, today was the start of the CPAC conference, which seemed to sort of be in disarray, a little all over the place. I think we're going to talk about that next week. Mm-hmm. But I think we should touch a little bit, just real quickly, just what's happening in the Senate right now. There was a vote on the state of emergency. Can we just touch on that real quick?
Yeah, there will be a vote on the state of emergency. So right now what's going on is the House of Representatives either has passed or will pass. I'm not sure if they voted on it today or not. They were supposed to. A resolution against the national emergency. So the way that the National Emergency Act works is that a president can decide to declare a national emergency about anything, essentially, right? It's very open-ended. But to prevent there from being this sort of rule by executive fiat structure, there's a sort of escape hatch that's built into the law, which says that if a resolution passes in the House and the Senate and is signed by the president, or if the veto is overcome in Congress, then you can undo an emergency resolution declaration, right? So the House either did vote or will vote tomorrow or Monday to pass a resolution that would undo the emergency resolution or the emergency declaration by Trump. That has to be approved by the Senate. So what's going on now is, of course, Senate Democrats are going to vote against the emergency declaration, right? So they're going to vote for the resolution against the declaration, and they have 47 votes. So they need three votes or four votes from the Republican side. So if they only get three votes, then Mike Pence, as vice president, becomes the tiebreaker, 51st vote, either for or against, right? So where things stand right now is there are three Republicans, Lisa Murkowski, Susan Collins, and I'm blinking on the name of the third, three Republicans who are going to vote for the resolution to undo the emergency declaration. What that means is that Democrats need one more vote. So there's something around, according to Politico, 10 Republican senators that are undecided right now as far as how they're going to vote. Some of those senators have been pretty out in the open about their feelings. So Lamar Alexander is one. He just wrote an open letter essentially to the White House, which got covered in Politico, essentially pleading with the White House to change course. Rand Paul is another one. So what unites this kind of group of 10 Republicans that are concerned about the emergency declaration is constitutional questions. So what they're concerned about essentially is that if the president is allowed to declare a national emergency over something that's not an emergency in order to win a policy fight, then essentially any president can do that for any reason. And they're not wrong about that. Democrats have already threatened to do that if they win the White House in 2020. And that is a really dangerous precedent. We start moving into a world of sort of a single branch government where the executive branch has almost total sovereignty at that point. As long as they control enough of the House and enough of the Senate to prevent there from being a veto that can be overcome. So say one of those senators, Republican senators, decides to vote for the resolution to undo the emergency declaration. What that would mean essentially is that that resolution would go to the White House for signature, go to Trump. Trump will veto it because he's already said he would. And then it would go back to the Senate, the House and the Senate, for a vote to overturn the veto. What that means is that in the Senate, I think it's 2/3 of senators have to vote to overturn a veto. And if they get to that 2/3, then they can overturn the veto and the emergency declaration goes away. What's very likely to happen from everything that's indicated today is that it is very likely that a single Republican senator will make the decision to be the deciding vote, and it will go to Trump's desk.
Trump will veto it and there won't be enough votes to overcome the veto. The important part about that, though, is that essentially what that means is that the Senate Republicans, or at least some of them, are willing to break with Trump publicly on his own signature policy. And then the amount of political capital Trump would have to expend, essentially, to be able to veto this and not have to go back on that himself is going to be pretty extreme, especially given that the public polling around the emergency declaration is not favorable to Trump right now. So if he loses a vote in Congress, too, it'll start to look like he's doing this kind of on his own. And that's not a great look when you're about to run for re-election. So that's sort of where that's at right now. I think the next couple days are going to be pretty interesting when it comes to the emergency declaration, for sure.
Yeah, we'll see what happens. And then switching to Cohen, I mean, as many people have pointed out, it seems like this is all stuff that we already knew. For instance, I read through the transcripts before he testified. For instance, all the stuff about, you know, Trump being a racist. This is stuff that came out. I find that really interesting, honestly, because, you know, in terms of what Trump said, I feel like it really didn't blow up in the media at all. You know, I feel like people were really hoping that he was going to say, like, the N-word or something. Whereas I feel like what he said was very damaging and very disgusting. I mean, he was literally saying that the reason that black people live in, mm-hmm. as what he called, shithole countries, which, again, people didn't connect it. For one, they didn't connect to him saying it then to when he said it, like, a year ago. He was talking about Haiti.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That connection wasn't made, but also just the fact that he was basically saying there's a biological reason in which African Americans or black people, wherever they're from, live in substandard conditions. It's because of something in their biology. And he was driving through, I believe, I don't know where it was, but he was with Cohen and he mentioned, he said only black people could live here.
Yeah.
And then he also said that black people were too stupid to vote for him, as if that's the reason. But again, I mean, the fact that he views it in terms of biology, mm-hmm. in fact, Cohen, I think, went farther in other reports where he was saying that, you know, I don't know, other things that were said. And other people that have been around him have also mentioned some of this very same statements and some other mm-hmm. worse things. But again, I mean, the fact that the president views it in terms of biology and just people's physical makeup is, I mean...
Yeah, and I think part of the reason – so if you read the really early coverage of the Cohen testimony, so right after his opening statement was finished, there were a bunch of articles written, and a lot of them did focus on Cohen's literal first sentence, which was, you know, I forget the exact words, but it started off with Donald Trump is a racist, right? And him mentioning that his reasons for sort of wanting to set the record straight in front of Congress and cooperate with the special prosecutor had to do, I mean, obviously with the fact he was getting charged, but also he specifically brought up Charlottesville and Helsinki as his.
I think his father, his grandfather was like a victim of the Holocaust or something like that.
Yeah. And so. There was a focus on that. I mean, Cohen went into all kinds of stuff about Trump's personal life, why he doesn't want people to release his grades from school because he performs so poorly, why he inflates
or threatens people over that.
What's up?
He threatened schools over that too.
Yeah. You know, Cohen talked about why he inflates and deflates his wealth depending on the expediency of doing so, right? But all of that, I think, kind of got pushed aside justifiably by two other dynamics that were happening during this hearing. The first of which was Jim Jordan, who, for those of you that aren't familiar with Jim Jordan, you should be, because he's a extreme right-wing Republican from Ohio. He's known for, you know, kind of being a Tea Party Republican. He also used to be a wrestling coach at Ohio State and is implicated in covering up a sexual abuse scandal that happened at the school while he was a coach there. So he goes on this rant at the beginning of the hearing about how Cohen is a liar and he's unreliable, and which is all what you would expect him to say. But then he veers off into essentially implying that the only reason Michael Cohen is saying any of the things he's saying is because this is part of a conspiracy being orchestrated by Hillary Clinton to take down Donald Trump. And when people heard that, there were a lot of reactions to that, partially because it's so off the rails. But the smarter kind of analysis of that moment really pointed to the inability of House Republicans to really leverage any arguments anymore. That even if Michael Cohen is not reliable, or you could paint him as not reliable, that doesn't mean that the individual data points he's bringing up aren't true. So there was that dynamic. And that dynamic ended up later leading to, I forget which lefty new House rep called Mark Meadows, another Republican House rep, a racist in the middle of the hearing. And there was a lot of back and forth. Anyways, that was one story, was the kind of political theater of all of this, which I want to get back to in a little bit. The second story was very specific things that Michael Cohen said. So it's important to keep in mind that Michael Cohen can't say anything that the prosecutors aren't going to allow him to say. So he can't release information they don't know about. He can't release new information that he hasn't told them about because he's a cooperating witness. So part of his plea agreement is he has to tell them everything. He has to be totally transparent, right? So there's nothing that he said that prosecutors don't already know, and they have to approve what he's going to talk about. So they read the statement that he gave. They read the statement that he gave before he was allowed to deliver it. So that's an important thing to keep in mind. So everything that's being said, prosecutors either in Mueller's team or in the Southern District of New York already know all of this. But if we back up from that a little bit, the revelations from Michael Cohen's testimony fall into sort of three camps, right? There's the sort of way Donald Trump does business revelations. Then there's the revelations about WikiLeaks, and then there's revelations about financial crimes. So on the first point, what Michael Cohen laid out was something that people who have paid attention to Trump for a while already knew, which is that the Trump Organization operates in a lot of ways not unlike organized crime, right? You've got one person who stays at the top. The entire business is based off that person's connections. No one in the organization outside of that person knows everything that's going on. But one of the things Cohen said specifically is that the way that Donald Trump does things is that he does things in such a way as to insulate himself from any legal liability. So if he wants someone to do something that might be illegal, he'll get them to go do it, but he'll get them to do it by only implying that that's what they should do. And so the example that Cohen used, and this is super relevant in relation to his own charges, but and the BuzzFeed story that came out, but the example that he used is that he said essentially Donald Trump didn't tell him directly to lie to Congress, which is what BuzzFeed alleged. What he said was that Trump told him to lie to Congress, quote, in his own way, namely indirectly, but in a way that's very clearly implied that that's what he should do. Essentially, it came down to Trump saying, telling Michael Cohen, you know, just make sure that everyone knows that that whole us negotiating over a Trump Tower in Moscow thing ended really early in the campaign, which Trump knew was not true. But the way that he said it very clearly implied that Michael Cohen should lie about that in front of Congress. And that's one of the things he's being charged with. He extended that into the whole story about the potential campaign finance violations around buying off mistresses and things like that. And actually, Michael Cohen brought a check that Trump had issued to him to reimburse him for the payment to Stormy Daniels that he had given to Michael Cohen in the Oval Office, which if that's true and if that check is legit, that would be a crime, right? That would be potential obstruction. It would definitely be campaign finance violations. There's potential perjury charges that could come from that and so on. So that's one part of it, is the Trump Organization operates not unlike organized crime, which is really interesting. The second revelations have to do with WikiLeaks. And specifically what Cohen was saying is that he was in Trump's office in Trump Tower during the campaign and overheard Roger Stone tell Donald Trump that WikiLeaks had obtained a bunch of Democratic Party emails, and they were going to dump them in a couple of days, and it would be very damaging to Hillary Clinton. And he said that over a speakerphone. Now, what's important about that is that nowhere in that statement did Cohen say that Trump knew that those emails came from Russian intelligence. Nowhere did Cohen say that Trump and WikiLeaks were actually coordinating strategy, right? All he said was that Trump had heard Roger Stone say that the emails were about to get dumped a few days before they got dumped. Now, what that does is that contradicts what Trump has said. That also contradicts what Roger Stone has said. If that's true, that might give us some insight into why Roger Stone's being charged with perjury right now. Because if Cohen could somehow prove that, that would definitely be a charge that Stone could be convicted of. So then there's – and what I would argue is probably the most important thing that Michael Cohen talked about, which was actually a totally separate investigation in the Southern District of New York around financial crimes. And what Cohen said specifically was that Trump doesn't want to release his tax returns, not because he's worried that people would know that he is worth less than he says, but because he's worried about tax evasion charges. And that if he were to release his tax returns, they would get additional scrutiny outside of the IRS. And that's possible that someone would find grounds to charge him with tax evasion. The reason that he thinks that is not only that he was involved in preparing Trump's taxes, but a guy named Alan Weiselberg, I think is how you pronounce his last name.
Weiselberg, wow.
Weiselberg. He's the CFO of the Trump Organization currently and also a cooperating witness with the Southern District of New York at the same time.
Right. He flipped on Trump.
Yeah, but he's still working for Trump.
Oh, my God.
Right. So like this guy had worked for Trump for, I think, 40 years, and he started off as Trump's personal accountant, just like the dude Trump went to file his taxes. And now he's the CFO of the Trump Organization, like 40 years later. But he's not only cooperating with the Southern District of New York, he's been granted immunity to cooperate with the Southern District of New York. What that means is that they had him on charges for financial crimes, and they were willing to give him immunity because his information was so damning. And so he has full immunity now, according to Michael Cohen, to give prosecutors in the Southern District of New York any information that they want. And that, according to Cohen, doesn't just focus on Donald Trump, but also Donald Trump Jr. If that's the case, and there have been other stories that have hinted at this, if that's the case, that becomes very interesting because there are a number of different ways that could play out. Southern District of New York could hold on to those charges until Trump's out of office and charge him with it then. They could try and indict him when he's in office. They could pass that information off to Congress and try and use it for the grounds for impeachment. I mean, there's a lot of different ways that could go. But if that's true, that is probably actually the biggest risk to Donald Trump right now, because he signs his tax returns. He has to. And that makes him legally liable for what's in them. And if he engaged in tax evasion, he could go to prison. That's a very real thing.
So one question I think a lot of people might be asking themselves is like, wait a minute. You know, one of the things they've been telling us on the news is that this week we were going to, you know, hear from Mueller. We were finally going to get the report. We didn't see it. Does that mean anything, or is that just the news stringing us along like usual?
It depends on where the information that Mueller was going to release the report came from to begin with. I mean,
this is most mainstream news was saying that this is what they were saying, that we were going to get it this week.
Yeah, and that there was some source that was saying that. It's still unclear who that source was.
Oh, gotcha.
Yeah, so, I mean, I mentioned this last week. I didn't see anything in the press that was convincing to me that the report was going to come out.
Okay.
I saw a lot of people sourcing the same news story, which sourced the same anonymous source saying that, and then a lot of other people repeating that in interviews and things. But I didn't see anything that would actually indicate that that's true.
Do you think in terms of just influencing anyone that's left in society that's still like on the fence at all about Trump, do you think that Cohen's testimony will do that? Or do you think that it just at this point people are already so solidified in their perceptions that it doesn't matter?
I think for a small sliver of people, it will. And the reason it will is the same. So there was a really good article. No, it was a post inside the live blog that 538 was doing. So if anyone wants to look at really good coverage from the Cohen testimony yesterday and really wants to dive into the kinds of ins and outs on a moment by moment basis, go look at 538, which is Nate Silver's blog. Go look at that. They did an amazing live blog yesterday. And part of what they were doing during that live blog is they were writing essentially abbreviated news articles into the live blog, which was cool. And something I really haven't seen a lot of journalists take the effort to do. But one of the articles that they posted was actually a comparison between Michael Cohen and John Dean. So for people that don't know who John Dean was Richard Nixon's – well, he was White House counsel under Richard Nixon, right? So he was the official attorney of the White House. And he had been implicated in Watergate because he had known about Watergate. He had helped with the cover-up. He got caught, and then he decided to turn. And at the beginning, Republicans in the House, when he was called to testify, said the same things they were saying about Michael Cohen. He's untrustworthy. He lied to Congress. He did this. He did that. And then the tapes came out. And when the tapes got released, it vindicated every single thing that John Dean had said. And he now has gone down in history as sort of this tragic figure who got caught up in something that was probably over his head. So the one thing that Michael Cohen did that was incredibly smart was he brought that check with him. That's the first concrete proof anyone has seen of an actual crime. And so there is a small sliver of people who I think had been on the fence about whether or not crimes have been committed by Trump that may have been convinced by this yesterday. Otherwise, though, this was purely political theater. It was meant to – for the Democrats, it was meant to build energy. If people listened to Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's questions to Michael Cohen, they were almost entirely centered on tax evasion. They were almost completely based on financial crimes. And that very clearly was a setup to request his tax returns. I think that's very clear. Elijah Cummings was also hinting at other possible avenues for investigation. So the Democrats are trying to build inertia for further investigations. What the Republicans were trying to do is they were trying to use this as a way to grandstand against the investigation. They came off sounding delusional in the process. But that's kind of not the point. I mean, what they're doing is they're talking to their base, and their base fully believes that the investigation is illegitimate, nothing bad happened, and blah, 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 blah. So a lot of this is about mobilizing base. And I think the sheer degree of political theater yesterday was very telling, very, very telling, as opposed to today, because Michael Cohen testified today, too, but in a closed session of the House Intelligence Committee. So we have no idea what was said during that. That focused on Russia.
Again, as we always ask, what does this testimony mean? I mean, is this going to solidify anything? I mean, is this just things we've already heard, so it really doesn't matter because it's already in the record? I mean, what does this actually mean for...
Yeah, so I think the Cohen testimony illuminated one thing, which I think was kind of being hinted at over and over and over again, but there was no real confirmation of. And that is that there are multiple investigations. There's not just one. I think there's a lot of focus on Mueller. But what Cohen did yesterday that was important was he provided context for a lot of the things that people thought was going on, right? So why is Roger Stone getting charged with perjury, right? Michael Cohen hinted at there being emails that he had sent where he talked about his connections to WikiLeaks, which he straight up denied when he testified in front of Congress, right? That would be grounds for perjury charges. If Michael Cohen had accessed those emails and passed them on to prosecutors, that would be the basis for a conviction, right? So he hinted a little bit at things like that. I think the other thing that he hinted at that was important was the Southern District of New York investigation, which – people knew was happening kind of in the sense that if you were paying really careful attention to what's been happening, you already knew that Alan Weiselberg had been cooperating. That's been known for months. But what he was cooperating around and what the investigation was centered on and things like that, no one really had any certain evidence about. Keep in mind, Michael Cohen used to be Trump's attorney. So if anyone's going to know that information, it's going to be him. And that was really important. I think one of the other elements of this, I think, is pretty critical in paying attention to what happened yesterday, was how much the House Republican argument against the investigation just completely collapsed. And it collapsed not just because Jim Jordan was being delusional and essentially went full-blown Alex Jones on that hearing, but it also kind of fell apart because there were a number of claims that House Republicans were repeating that have been said for months, but at this point are kind of nonsensical. So for a lot of them, they just kept repeating, the only reason you're testifying is because you want a sentence reduction. But Michael Cohen's already been sentenced, so this wouldn't give him any advantage in that, right?
Oh, that was just, like you said before, that was political theater. It's like, yeah. You're a rat, you're a liar. It's like, yeah, who did he lie for? The president. So what's right. your point?
That's the other thing that's really interesting, and that got pointed out in an article, I think, on CNN, if I'm remembering correctly. I read a lot of articles about this yesterday. But one of the things they pointed out is the argument that was being made – oh, no, it was on Vox. That's where it was. The argument that was being made here was essentially, you're a rat because you lied, but if you continue that sentence to cover up for something that the person that the House Republicans are supporting did.
Well, yeah, it's like a double-fisted thing. It's like, yeah, you're a rat, you turned your back on the president and your friends.
Yeah.
Okay. But then also, you're a liar and a felon. Yeah, who's in trouble for doing the things that he was told to do.
Yeah.
That
was so clearly a fallacious argument yesterday that about halfway through the hearing, they stopped repeating it because they sounded ridiculous. What that tells me, though, is that their strategy for trying to fight this off has entirely imploded. They've lost that argument at this point. Yeah.
Well, also, I think they're just trying to come up with terms that resonate with people because, sure. I mean, most people, thankfully, don't like snitches and they don't like tattletales. And,
right.
But at the same time, it's like you've got somebody in office that literally lies about their taxes so they don't have to pay them. And
yeah.
Like, just swindles each and every way and lies out their ass every single chance they get. I mean, that's like literally they created a culture around it. I mean,
yes. Well, one of the things that Cohen did to a really extreme degree yesterday, and this is where statements about Trump's grades or him faking an injury to not go to Vietnam, like why those became relevant. Because what Cohen was doing, keep in mind, I mean, he used to be a trial attorney, right? What Cohen was doing was he was setting up the idea that this is a pattern with Trump, that this is not new. This is something he's been doing his entire life, and this is just another manifestation of that. And so that – we'll see how much that resonates. But for some people that might be on the fence about whether or not they're going to continue to support Donald Trump, if they can get convinced that this is a pattern with him, which anyone that's ever paid attention to him knows that it is. But if they can be convinced of that, that's another sliver of support that's going to go away. Because there are a lot of people, specifically people on the religious right, that, you know, they'll tolerate a lot when it comes to a candidate, especially if that candidate ostensibly says that they're anti-choice, right? Like they'll tolerate a lot. But there is a limit to that, right? And I think that that's important to recognize. One of the important things that this all points out is that the entire kind of structure that Donald Trump fell into, and literally, according to Cohen, fell into, is one that, when you couple it with his personality, facilitates kind of extreme abuses of power, right? So, like, we already live at a time in which executive power has been concentrated over the last 20 years to a degree that's never really been seen in American history. And then you take someone like Donald Trump, who, you know, the way that Cohen described the Trump Organization is not dissimilar from the way the White House is functioning right now. It's all based on personal connections, not necessarily skill. It's all based on who is willing to toe the line and do whatever Trump says without asking too many questions. And that's why you end up with people like Stephen Miller being influential people within the White House, because Stephen Miller does not have the resume or the intelligence to ever be in that position. But what he is willing to do is he is willing to go on TV and tell everyone that Donald Trump is a political genius, in his words, and just defend that position to his death, right? And Trump loves that. And so he'll continue to utilize people like that. But it definitely, the way that American politics is structured, facilitates abuses of power by someone like Trump, especially after 20 years of concentration of power in the executive branch. So, and that was a point Cohen also made, right? I mean, one of the things I found very striking about what he said yesterday wasn't the content, it was the tone. And again, who knows how honest he's being with this? But from what I saw a person who screwed up, knows that they screwed up, got lost in a world in which screwing up was considered okay, and then got ripped out of that world and realized everything they had done, and that this is part of his attempt at repentance, essentially. I think after looking at his body language and hearing his tone, I'm willing to take him at his word on that. And if that's true, that's a pretty stunning recrimination from someone who worked for somebody else for over 20 years, right? That you're just going to turn your back on someone and go, everything this person said is a lie and everything that they're about is evil and horrible. That's saying a lot.
Well, let's move forward from Cohen, at least in terms of talking about the testimony. We also wanted to talk about this really good Crime Think article, this really good Crime Think article that came out. And it's talking about the Mueller investigation, putting it in terms of a context that encourages people basically to wait and engage in the spectacle that's in front of them as opposed to organizing and taking action on their own or collectively. And I think this has some really good points and really speaks to the reality that we're in. You know, I was just talking to people talking about Block the Wall actions, and they were saying they felt like if these would have been called for a year ago, we would have had, you know, triple the numbers out in the streets.
Yeah.
And it definitely feels like we're in a moment right now where a lot of people's energy has been sucked up by the political spectacle and just waiting to see what's going to happen.
Yeah. And I think one of the key points in that piece, which I found very salient and that I found was articulated incredibly well, is this sort of, without getting too jargony about it, but they're kind of two different sorts of time that we're living in right now, right? Really, I would say three different sorts of time that we're living in right now. We have this kind of temporality of everyday life that we live, right? Where things are very immediate, you know, we have to go grocery shopping, do the laundry, and like go to work and stuff, and like take care of the kids and all those things, you know. The mundane elements of everyday life, this kind of world that we live in, grafted on top of that world is this world of statecraft, right? And we've talked about this before in relation to Carl Schmitt, but we end up in this living in this kind of bifurcated space, right? And so we have this very immediate life. We have this world of statecraft, right? What in the United States we call politics, but is really just statecraft. There's not much politics there. And in that world, there's this kind of total suspension that's going on, right? One of the things that the article point that this piece points out, which I think was a really good point, is that, you know, the height of resistance to Donald Trump and to the Trump administration was at the beginning. I know we mentioned last week the demonstrations and riots and property destruction and stuff that happened immediately following his election through the inauguration. And then that led into the airport protests, right, which were wildly successful and pulled all kinds of people that don't usually go to direct action things out into the street. And it was amazing. But after the Mueller investigation started, there's been almost a total retreat. And if people are active, they tend to be active. And of course, there's exceptions to this, right? I mean, anti-fascist organizing, anarchist organizing.
The fact that there's been more strikes than there have been in like three decades.
Yeah, labor organizing, stuff like that. But if you look at the normal Democrat in the United States who's not an anti-borders organizer or a trade unionist or an anarchist or something like that, they've pretty much retreated back into this position of just waiting for the Mueller investigation to finish. The way that it was worded in...
Well, not only that, but we are also in a period where we're post-midterms as well.
Yeah, yeah.
So that kind of urgency is now, you know, things are a little more normal now. You know, the Mueller investigation is running. We've got Democrats, you know, in the House. Things are a little more back to normal, I think a lot of people would say.
Yeah, and that – so that kind of suspension where time doesn't really feel like it's moving at all, right? Where it's this kind of constant churn of news where everyone's sort of like looking at signs and waiting for things to come to a culmination was referred to in the article as hell, which is a really interesting kind of early Christian reference to concepts of hell as being the sort of like constant suspension where nothing happens, right? Or as the Catholic Church would later say, purgatory, right, where it's just total neutrality. You have a lot of people who are kind of stuck in this position. What this position does, what this position of suspension does, is it essentially suspends any sort of activity which would exist outside of the given parameters of state sovereignty. So if we look at really what the Mueller investigation is, for those people that are very much sort of putting all of their political eggs in that basket, and there's a lot of people doing that, in that worldview, essentially the narrative is Donald Trump is an exception to an otherwise okay system, and Robert Mueller is the force that is going to return everything to rightness. A lot of those people forget or just never know or never knew. Robert Mueller was also the head of the FBI when the FBI declared, quote, environmental extremism as the biggest threat to the United States, right? This was a period of time which was very difficult for environmentalists, radicals, people like that who are dealing with FBI harassment on a pretty constant basis. And so what Robert Mueller is doing is, in his view, trying to return the system to balance. But in this sort of waiting process, in the suspension process, what's been lost is any kind of conversation about whether that in itself is a good thing. And I know myself, I've had this conversation with a lot of people I know. I know a lot of other people that have had this conversation, but this whole idea of waiting for Mueller to finish the investigation is essentially the same position as waiting for the political system as it exists to exist better. Or it's the same position as, you know, relying on police internal affairs to investigate police violence, that we just assume that that's going to make everything okay. Right. There's very clear problems with that. And so I think that that part of this is kind of the key. The other thing, though, is that at the same time all this is happening, there's this kind of constant process of political crisis that's happening all the time. And what that does is it kind of returns everything to an immediacy, but one that we're very removed from. And so the result of this kind of disorienting, constant total political scandal, right, that none of us have any ability to really influence, and that a lot of people are sort of relying on to, quote, fix the problem, right? And what that's done is it's entirely prevented anyone from being able to or willing to organize autonomous activity against Trump and against the state in general, right? And so at this point where I think a lot of us, if you were to ask this 2 years ago, what would be happening in 2019, after Trump got elected, we'd be like, oh, yeah, there's going to be like tons of resistance in the street. And we would have all been wrong, right? Instead, what we're looking at is we're looking at dynamics which fundamentally prevent people from being able to find enough grounding or enough motivation to do anything. And it's led to almost total stasis.
It's been interesting, too, because I think, you know, one of the big perceptions I had was that all of the big left groups from like Answer, you know, all the ones that were really active during the anti-war movement, you know, they were going to like, you know, kind of come to the fore and be organizing mass marches. But if you look at things like the players that have really kind of like done the mass march type deal, that's been more like AstroTurf movements that have really been tied to the Democrats. We haven't really seen the big lefty force right now is the DSA.
Yeah.
And they have kind of like a community organizing wing, and they have more of like a incubator program for the progressive end of the Democratic Party. And that's kind of like where it's at.
Yeah.
So,
and even them, I mean, and we've talked about this a lot, I think, over the last
sure.
month. Even them, what is the goal of the DSA? Essentially, they would never admit this, but the reality is that those policies will make capitalism more comfortable and allow it to continue to function. Right.
Sure. I'm just pointing out it's just been interesting that the traditional left players have kind of like been absent, which has been good for anarchists because it's basically allowed more of an open playing field. But I think it also shows just how much work we have to do in like building a robust movement that actually can get a lot of people out.
Yeah.
But also, the need to build up infrastructure to have, reverberation within the wider working class, the need to organize things, all these basic tenets, you know?
Yeah. And I think there's another takeaway from this piece for me, which I think is pretty critical, right? So there's a tendency amongst anarchists to kind of take this position of saying, here's this thing I don't like for political reasons, and I'm not going to pay attention to it because it's bad, right? So we saw this with economics. A lot of people were pretty comfortable with general critiques of capitalism, but there wasn't a lot of drive to understand the nuances of, say, structural adjustment programs by the IMF, right? Which are things we should understand on a strategic level, that if we're incapable of being able to explain that, we're also incapable of being able to respond to it effectively. And take that as part of our strategic context to be able to do that. And one of the takeaways I got from this piece as part of my reflection on this is, on one hand, yeah, everything is being said in the piece is absolutely accurate, right? Like, there is this waiting period. That waiting period has essentially completely prevented functional resistance from actually operating inside the United States, outside of anarchists, and so on. And that is totally worthy of as much critique as we can throw at it. And I think we probably all need to be a lot more vocal about that. But at the same time that that's true, what is happening is fundamentally modifying the strategic context that we're operating in. And so whether it's regime collapse of just the Trump administration, or whether we're looking at the general implosion of American hegemony, or whether we're looking at the delegitimization of the liberal democratic state, all of these things are going on at the same time right now. And there's this incredible amount of churn. And so if we can get away from, and there's a lot of people that have kind of fallen into, I would even say, a somewhat understandably reactionary stance in relation to the Mueller investigation. If we can wrench ourselves away from that, we can actually start to embrace all of the churn that is going on in our strategic context, be able to understand that by paying attention to what's going on in the investigation, while not at the same time relying on the investigation to, quote, solve our problems, right? And I think that that's probably ultimately where we all need to be right now. Major shout out to the people that wrote that piece, because it's awesome.
This has been the It's Going Down podcast. Check itsgoingdown.org for daily updates, columns, action reports, and news. Go to itsgoingdown.org/shop to support us. And follow us on all social media platforms. IGD, your daily resource for insurgent proletarian life.